a U.S. economy that needs a kickstart. Fuel prices causing pain and frustration. What America needs is a scooter that gets 80 miles to the gallon. There. Music to my ears. At least we got one engine started. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
I'll agree with that. One engine getting started is a good thing.
I agree.
Good morning, folks. It's Friday, May 2nd. This hour on The Takeaway, big scooter sales could be the newest economic indicator. The real life pain of being poor, it's actually a medical issue. Andrea Bernstein in Indiana tracking Obama-Clinton looks like a dead heat. We've got movies and all the news. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in London, and she continues to accuse Iran of developing nuclear weapons. Rice says she suspects Iran's intentions aren't geared toward a civil nuclear program. She also says Iran's insistence on being able to enrich uranium contradicts its goal of constructing a peaceful program.
You can add food insecurity to the prolonged war as a problem in Afghanistan. Hungry Afghans are turning to old bread scraps for their meals as the cost of wheat flour has shot up 75% in 3 months. The UN's World Food Program is warning that the situation for Afghanistan's poor is dire. The food crisis has become a security issue for President Bush.
And so today I'm asking Congress to provide an additional $770 million to support food aid and development programs.
The president says stepped-up global food aid would help ease political instability in hard-hit areas.
Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, lawmakers were investigating the food crisis here in the United States. Here's Senator Charles Schumer speaking before the Joint Economic Committee.
You hear people complaining about food prices almost as much as gas prices. I believe the anxiety felt over higher food prices is going to be just as widespread.
An Agricultural Department economist told the committee yesterday that corn-based ethanol is partially to blame for high food prices. In Zimbabwe, they are still counting the votes from the March 29th election, which the opposition continues to claim it won. A spokesman for the opposition said today ruling leader Robert Mugabe should simply step down.
The honorable thing to do is to resign and begin to start thinking about retirement. As far as we're concerned, we've urged him to resign, and he should resign and allow the Zimbabwean people to move forward.
The Mugabe government claims a recount will show that a runoff election is needed to determine the next president.
Big economic news is The Takeaway this week. Labor Department will announce the April jobless figure this hour. Economists predict a fourth month in a row of losses, and the markets begin the day up. You know, scooters are an economic indicator. We want your answer to this question. You see an economic downturn when you see things like this.
Hi, my name is Becky. I'm calling from Winthrop, Massachusetts. I know the economy's in a downturn when I see Lexus, Mercedes-Benz, and Jaguars in the parking lot at the Salvation Army.
That's great. Call 877-8-MY-TAKE to give us your favorite economic indicator of a downturn. Or you can...
You can fill in the blank, or you can...
Email.
My take. You
That's
can send us an email if I could just get that out. mytake@thetakeaway.org. Fill
economic
in the blank.
Indicators. All hour.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Friday, May 2nd, and this week we've seen simply a barrage of economic news, and we are expecting the Labor Department in the next half an hour to release new unemployment numbers. Now, that's on top of a Federal Reserve interest cut that happened on Wednesday and more big layoffs announced by companies. Here's a sampling of the headlines.
Prices jumped nearly 30%.
More than doubled since 2001.
28%.
13%. Another quarter point.
0.6% for the first 3 months of the year.
3.25 points.
Cut another quarter percent.
Up 0.6%.
Down less than half a point.
The 18.5-cent federal gas tax.
I mean, no good choices for the Fed right now.
The numbers haven't all been encouraging, but the stock market is up. David Leonhardt covers the economy for the New York Times. So, David, based on your reporting, what kind of shape are we in?
Well, we're not in very good shape, but I think we're not in as bad shape as some people feared a few weeks ago. And I think that's why you see the stock market rallying a little bit. And one thing that, it's not perfect, but one thing I like to look at is this contract that trades on InTrade, which is a website where you can buy and sell futures contracts. They actually sell a contract tied to whether the United States will go into the economy this year.
You can bet?
You can bet.
The recession.
The same way you can bet on the presidential race. Have you heard about this site?
Yeah, sure.
Right? So right now it's saying that there's about a 75% chance that Obama will get the Democratic nomination. It's saying there's about a 40% chance that McCain will beat whoever the Democrat is in November. And it's saying that there's about a 33% chance that the U.S. economy will go into recession this
33%.
Year. 33%. And just a few weeks ago, it was up by 75%. And so
that's your favorite economic indicator.
Well,
we're asking people for economic indicators all morning today. And if you want to call and give you ours, by the way, I'm just going to remind people, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. That's a great economic
indicator. A great one. Actually, at 33%, I'd actually buy it. I think the odds that we're going to have a recession this year are bigger than that. But that just shows you that some of the numbers we've gotten recently have not been as bad as people thought. And so they think there's a chance we're just going to end up muddling through this year.
Well, let's talk about these unemployment numbers today. What is the preview? Any sense of what we can expect this morning?
There's a report that a group called ADP puts out that tries to estimate what the unemployment numbers are going to show. Actually, what the employment numbers are going to show, the number of jobs created or lost. It's not yet clear how accurate that survey is, but it suggests that there'll be a gain of about 10,000 jobs, which may sound good because a gain sounds better than a loss.
Right.
But really, the benchmark we should use shouldn't be zero because the population's always growing. So the benchmark should really be closer to something like 100,000 jobs, maybe even more than 100,000 jobs.
And that's to meet the need.
That exists. Exactly. That's just to keep things
to match the growing economy.
To match the growing population.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know, we had a really interesting discussion yesterday about GDP figures. Remember, and Peter was saying that
day before yesterday
that the inventories, businesses were holding on to their inventories according to the GDP. Is that possibly a reason why employment seems to be relatively stable? Businesses are keeping workers on to build up inventories?
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, it's very expensive to get rid of workers, mainly because...
Did you hear that, guys?
It's very expensive to have to rehire them. And so if you're not yet sure, let's say you think there's a 33% chance the economy is going to go into recession, it makes sense to hold on to your workers for longer in the hope that you may not have to get rid of them. But at a certain point, if business turns down, then you've got double problems, right? You've got goods sitting in your warehouses, and you've got workers you have to get rid of.
And the other numbers that we came across that were very interesting is the fact that some folks in surveying find that for every $1,000 your average American makes, we're only saving $2.
Yeah.
So we don't have any money in the bank. People lose their jobs, and that creates a whole nother vacuum in itself. But is that a function of bad habits, do you think, or is that the result of the increasing cost of gas and food and other daily needs?
I think it's both. I mean, I do think it's some level of people consuming now instead of saving for the future. But I also think it's a result of the fact that we're now coming out of an economic expansion that's lasted so far about 7 years, and yet the average family hasn't gotten a raise during that time. That's really remarkable.
In 7 years?
Yeah. I mean,
so the real income has not grown.
That's right, for most households. So the economy came out of recession in late 2001, November 2001, and it's been growing ever since. And yet most families do not make as much, adjusted for inflation, as they did in 2000 at the peak of the last expansion.
Why is that? When we read about all the time about corporations who are making record profits, I mean, the oil industry, which is not necessarily the best example, but we've seen extraordinary numbers in the last quarter of billions, tens of billions of dollars among all of the companies that they are pulling in. Why is that not being translated to the average worker?
The first thing to say is that people don't completely understand it. Economists don't completely understand it. There's a list of reasons that people like to give, and people on the left emphasize some more than others, and people on the right emphasize others more than some. But
so on the left, it's greedy bastards, and on the right, it's trickle-down economics. Is that how it works?
I would say the left tends to talk a lot about the decline of unions, and I would say the right tends to talk a lot about soaring healthcare costs, which take a bite out of wages. And I would say both sides tend to agree, but put different weights on technology and globalization.
President Bush is expected to speak for the second time this week about the state of the economy. And this comes the day after Secretary of Treasury Henry Paulson said that he believed that we are closer to the end of this cycle than the beginning. Do you think that's what President Bush is likely to come out and reinforce today? And what are they saying this based on? Do you have any sense?
I think policymakers in general think it's their job to talk optimistically. I think whether it's people in administration or people in Congress, I think, one, there are political reasons why they want to talk up the economy. And two, that there are actually some fundamental economic reasons. I think they're worried that if they talk about it in worrisome tones, it'll actually make things worse. But I wouldn't put too much stock in what a sitting president or Treasury secretary is saying as a forecast.
Right. They're just happy, smiling people holding hands, as REM might say.
And it's, you know, it's not just the Bush White House. There was an interview with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, recently in which she said, I don't like to talk about recession. I think it's important to have confidence. And that's
right,
fine.
Right.
Just let's not take their forecasts too seriously.
We're going to focus on a economic indicator here in a second. David,
we're
going
to ask
on.
You
yeah.
to, yeah.
Yeah, David Leonhardt of the New York Times. Hold on. Here's my favorite economic indicator.
So you're interested in a scooter?
Yes.
Yeah. Why? What's making you interested in a scooter?
I think for the mileage that we have and for the gas pipe.
Instead of driving the Jeep, you know, we can hop on the scooter and, 70, 80 miles a gallon, you know?
That's pretty good. That's working for you.
It's working. The idea. Yeah.
Outside of the scooter bodega in Brooklyn yesterday, there was a line of Vespas and a line of people actually investigating the cost of purchasing one of these scooters that get 80 miles to the gallon. And everyone we spoke with yesterday said fuel prices are the reason. Bob Hedstrom, how you doing
Good
this morning?
Morning.
You're the owner of Scooterville, which is a scooter store in Minneapolis, right?
That is correct.
Are people in Minneapolis considering scooters these days?
More than ever. This is our seventh season, and we have had steady growth over the 7 years, but in about the 15 to 20% range. This year, we are up 100% over last year.
Now, if people are buying more scooters, that could be for a lot of reasons, but if people are buying more scooters in Minneapolis, where it gets down to like 50 below in the winter, that seems like a cry for help from the economy. What do you think?
Absolutely. It's we have had a horrible spring. Spring is very late coming this year, but that hasn't seemed to dampen the enthusiasm of people looking for a transportation alternative.
That's incredible. So it's been freezing cold, and still your sales are through the roof.
Yes. Last week, for example, we had a total rainout on Thursday and Friday. On Saturday, it actually snowed. For the entire week, we sold.
I'm sorry. When did it snow?
It snowed on Saturday.
You mean as in last weekend?
The most recent Saturday, the 27th, 26th, whatever that was.
And you still had people in your store buying Vespa scooters?
For the entire week, we sold 32 bikes. And in the entire month of April of 2007, we sold 27 bikes.
For the whole year?
No, for the month of April.
Oh, I see.
Bob, that is a fantastic number. That is more indicative of what's going on in the economy than anything I've heard all morning. Bob Hedstrom, owner of Scooterville in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Sure, thanks.
David Leonhardt of the New York Times. What do you think of the Scooterville number there, huh?
That's great.
Isn't that great?
And one of the things about energy costs for most families is it's really hard to cut back a little bit. Right, it's hard to turn your commute from 25 miles to 20 miles, so you have to cut back in big ways. When you have a chance to buy a new vehicle or a scooter, sometimes people start to do it that way.
Call 877-8-MY-TAKE and answer this question. I know the economy is bad when I see
X, blank,
whatever. We're looking for your economic indicators. Yours is the website, right? The betting website. I like scooters. Adora likes...
I like Animals in the Pound.
Animals
I used to
in
do
the pound.
Some volunteering, and every time times get a little tough, you see a lot more dogs and cats
that's
being dumped.
That's so interesting. All right, that's it. Oh, my take at thetakeaway.org. That's also a way to get in touch with us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Next Tuesday, it's primary day in Indiana and North Carolina. In Indiana, of course, there are 72 delegates at stake, which is where we sent the Takeaway's political director, Andrea Bernstein. She's been traveling I-65, which is the north-south route in Indiana. She started in Gary earlier in the week and made it through Bloomington and joins us today. Andrea, good morning.
Good morning.
Where are you?
Well, I am actually so close to Kentucky that I'm in Kentucky.
You're in Kentucky. So you've crossed the border. You're out of the zone.
I did. I'm at Louisville Public Radio this morning, but it took me about 2 minutes to get here from Jeffersonville, which is where I was yesterday, and which is where Hillary Clinton was also yesterday.
Well, let's hear from some of the voter voices that you sent to us and then talk about your reaction to having spent the week in Indiana. Here are the voices.
I'd say the economy overall. That's why you see all these motorcycles here, because it's cheaper to fill up a motorcycle than a car.
Issue. How about the Bear Stearns taxpayer bailout?
What do you think about that?
I think it is awful. I think it's wrong. It's more shades of wrong than a brand new bruise.
Now, what do you guys think about the gas tax holiday that she's proposing? You think that's a good idea?
I don't think it matters one way or another. I do like the fact that she's found a way to pay for it, because the money is used for a good purpose, and that's to fix the roads and highways. So she did come up with a plan to pay for it. McCain did not.
I wouldn't vote for Democratic. I don't think there's enough money in the world to do all the things that they think they can afford to do. I think they ought to get a hammer and sickle and just have a society of give them all. Take care of them from birth to the cradle.
I didn't want to like her, but as soon as I got in the whole mode for the rally, it was like, wow!
And what do you think about Obama? Do you think he has good ideas, too?
I think
too?
He has outstanding charisma, but I also think he's really young and can easily run in 8 years after we have 8 years of outstanding Hillary. So,
wow, from hammer and sickle to outstanding Hillary. That's quite a contrast, Andrea.
Yes. You know, and as you can hear in the tape, pretty much when I left Bloomington yesterday, I drove out of the Midwest and into the South. When I stopped to get a soda at a convenience store, I looked in the cooler, and instead of sodas, I saw night crawlers and red wigglers.
Oh, doing a little fishing down there, huh?
So, and you can hear in their voices what it is here in southern Indiana, which is to say it's the South, and, you know, it's the white South, which is an area where Hillary Clinton has proved strong and continues to appear strong. I spoke to quite a few people in downtown Jeffersonville yesterday evening, and I think I found two people who were supporting Obama out of about maybe 30 or 40 people interviewed.
Well, the statistics show dead heat in Indiana, but you know, this, given the engagement of these voters into the issues, as indicated by your tape, it seems to me this is going to be a very interesting contest come next Tuesday.
Yeah, I think the dynamic has really changed here this week for a couple of reasons. If you looked at the early polls, the polls last week, there was a large undecided. And the whole issue with the Reverend Wright has put a kind of a damper on the people who were leaning towards Obama, who were struggling on the question of experience, change, experience. This is a debate that's been going on since the beginning, since Iowa, and I've heard it a lot. But that's had a big dynamic. The economy is huge, and the sense of struggle in Indiana in many, many parts of people really not being sure how they're going to pay for their groceries. Really a lot of desperate people throughout the state. And those people have gone to Hillary Clinton. And, you know, one of the things I heard here yesterday was she has a plan.
Can I just interrupt you for just 1 second? Because we have David Leonhard here from The New York Times. And this plan, the gas tax plan, You know, let me ask David, what do economists think of this plan? There are people responding to it in the tape that Andrea had there.
Just explain it very quickly for those who don't understand.
So the idea is basically, and Clinton and McCain have similar ideas here. As one of the voters interviewed noted, they are somewhat different. Clinton plans to pay for it with a tax on oil company profits, and McCain doesn't so much. But basically, what they want to do is suspend the federal tax on gasoline, give people a price break on gasoline this summer because of how expensive it is. Almost universally, if there's someone who likes this idea, I haven't found them yet. Economists and also environmental experts don't like this plan. They think it is far more politics than it is economics. Because, first of all, it's not a huge amount of money that you'll be saving people. Second of all,
I think Obama said something like maybe $30 a family.
That sounds right. If it's wrong, I don't think it's off by much. I'm not sure exactly.
That's interesting.
But the real issue is, to the extent that you cut the price of gas, people will drive more, right? Supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
And when they then drive more, the price of gas goes right back up because there's more demand. And so really what you're doing is you're taking money away from the federal government. You're not so much putting it in the pockets of Americans. In all likelihood, you're putting it in the pockets of oil producers, Canada, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Russia.
And if the roads fall apart from not paying the taxes to fix the roads, Andrea, there in Indiana, that also lowers fuel economy, right?
So. Well, you know, I mean, Clinton says that she would take the money from the oil companies. I mean, the sort of legislative complexity of having that happen seems a big hurdle to have it happen by Memorial Day, which is, of course, at the end of this month. But, you know, I actually had yesterday the campaigns have these daily conference calls, and I had a back and forth with Jeff Guerin, the head of the Clinton campaign, and with Harold Wolfson about this. And the way they are really casting this, when you ask them this, and when you ask them, you know, can you get an expert that supports you, what they say is people are hurting, they need relief, we want to help them out. And if you oppose this, you're an elitist and you don't understand the problems of ordinary people. And at one point, Jeff Guerin said to me, well, what driving would you have people stop? Would you have them stop driving to work? And, you know, the answer is, and Clinton has herself said this in other moments, that there is drive, people drive too much, and part of her energy policy is to get people to drive less.
Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein in Indiana, where former DNC chairman Joe Andrews said yesterday he was switching his support as a superdelegate from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama, a big story in Indiana. Andrea Bernstein is blogging on our website. But now we have more headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. The Federal Reserve, in coordination with the European central banks, say they will work together. The Fed announced today that it's going to add to its emergency reserves in the supplies to the US banks, and they're going to increase that supply to $150 billion this month. In international news, the US Treasury freezes the assets of three Burmese companies. The request came from President Bush, who says the state-owned companies are exploiting the labor of the people of Burma. For the first time, the United States has made official diplomatic contact with the leader of Nepal's former rebel Maoists. The US ambassador, Nancy Powell, met Pushpa Kamal Dahal in Kathmandu. The BBC's Charles Haviland has more on the official statement released earlier today.
Saying this was their first meeting, the statement added that the two discussed the outcome of last month's elections and that Ms. Powell encouraged Mr. Dahal to ensure that the Maoists show their commitment to the political process through their words and actions.
The Maoist Communist Party won recent national elections but is still listed as a terrorist group by Washington.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father walked out on her 20 years ago and a daughter who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Better than expected job numbers out from the Labor Department. The unemployment rate stands at 5%. We'll have more from Femi Okay later on. We have economic indicators from you folks on our website. I notice when times are hard, says Franz, because I feel like my social relationship with my friends suffers because, you know, you just don't see each other anymore. Elizabeth says from Boston, when I see a third of the American people deciding not to take summer vacations, I see economic downturn. Somebody else says people are working more diligently at their jobs. That's my economic indicator.
But also, we've been talking a lot about politics. It's going to be a mad dash to the finish line for presidential hopefuls Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton this weekend. They'll be campaigning around the clock. I mean, they are going to be going at it from the beginning of the day until the end of the night in Indiana and North Carolina, because every vote is going to count ahead of Tuesday's primary. And that means a lot of speeches. And of course, we all feel, right, David Walrice, we all feel like we know the candidates by now because we've listened to them
They've been president for 4 years.
But maybe not, right? I mean, yeah. Morehouse College professor David Walrice is an expert in listening between the lines. And you took a look at some of the speeches, and what kinds of things from either or both candidates really stand out to you about the kinds of things that they're saying?
Well, I think thinking in broad strokes, one thing that comes out is if you look at Hillary Clinton, one thing that she's very interested in is she's kind of betting on her being there, her being within the body politic, right? And so she talks about who is going to be the best person, the best fit, who's there and able to get the job done on day one. So in that respect, she's not betting on a reveal, which is what Barack Obama is really doing. Barack Obama is really inviting you into his world. He's saying that, you know, there's nowhere else except in the United States of America that my story is even possible. He has a very personal appeal. We all know how charismatic and engaging he is. And when you hear folks yelling out in his rallies, you know, I love you, he turns with a very sly smile and a wink and says, I love you back.
Oh, so this girl yesterday we had him from Indiana who was crying.
Oh, wow.
Crying, talking to our reporter.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, just about having been there.
Listening to him. Well, let's take a listen to one bit of what Obama has said repeatedly as he has done his gone around the country giving his stump speeches.
Sure.
This belief comes from my unyielding faith in the decency and generosity of the American people. But it also comes from my own story. I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas.
David, how important is that personal narrative, and how much of it has been a part of what Barack Obama has been talking about?
I think it, in large part, has defined his candidacy. I mean, in terms of what he's talking about, it's very important because what he's doing is he's trying to ask for the American public to ride with them, right? So what he's saying is that I really want for you to be with me. I want you to know who I am. I want you to know that I am who you are. And so that personal reveal becomes very important because he's hoping to engage and be engaged by the American public. And so that, of course, has had a resounding effect with respect to how he's run his candidacy and all these people kind of chipping in $25, $30, $40 and really having an American movement, quote unquote, is what he's kind of leaning on.
It's also created Hillary's response, where Hillary says, personal narrative, don't look at that.
Right.
Personal narrative disqualifies you, even though every other thing that comes out of Hillary's mouth is, I was in this field getting taught by my grandpa to shoot over here. So, I mean, she's got a bunch of personal narrative, too.
Sure. Well, let's take a listen to what Hillary Clinton has said.
For me, the victory we share tonight is deeply personal. It was here in Pennsylvania where my grandfather started work as a boy in the lace mills and ended up as a supervisor 5 decades later. It was here where my father attended college and played football for Penn State. And I am back here tonight because of their hard work and sacrifice.
Yeah, I'm getting sick of these personal narratives myself.
But how do people use these narratives, do you think, to make decisions? I mean, you're a psychologist, you're a sociologist. I mean, this is what you spend your time observing.
Well, I think the narratives, I mean, I understand being sickened by them, you know, because you hear them ad nauseum. But I think that the thing that's so important about them is these really are gateways into being a part of the body politic, right? And so I think that, you know, the thing that's very interesting about Hillary's narrative, it seems a bit forced. It seems a bit forced to me. Because she says that, you know, this story for me is very personal. It's almost like if you have to tell somebody how personal it is, you really don't feel them, right? But with Barack Obama, it really seems like there's that ease there. So that is his kind of his way in.
But Adora was asking, and I think this is really the key, how does that figure into the decision process? I mean, do you want Obama when, you know, we're in the middle of a war going, you know, my mom was white and my dad was black? Yeah,
right.
I mean, we don't want him necessarily thinking about that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think on one hand that could very much be the case. I mean, but this really kind of is telltale of how close this race is right now. So, I mean, the experience and the being there, of course, matters a whole lot. But when you look at the experience to this point in time, you're like, well, what else is there? And you really are trying to have somebody in there who can kind of relate and make the type of decisions that you trust for them to make.
And the bottom line is both of these candidates have teams of people who are helping them form what they're going to say wherever they go, and to maintain, as they say in the political world, the message, create this continuity of message. How much do you think is created by that team, and how much truly is indicative of who those individual candidates are?
That's the million-dollar question.
Well, I think that is the million-dollar question.
Is that something we can tell in listening to the speeches?
I mean, you know, it depends on how good the politician is, quite frankly.
Well, hold that thought for a second. We definitely want to hear about that, David Walrice. But we've got breaking news from Femi OK.
The Labor Department says employers cut 20,000 jobs in April. That was fewer than economists actually expected. The employment rate now dips to 5%. In other news, President Bush is in St. Louis to talk about boosting the economy, and Condoleezza Rice is in London negotiating Middle East peace. In the sporting world, Kevin Durant was named the NBA Rookie of the Year, delivering a glimmer of joy to the Seattle Supersonics. The Sonic went 20-66 in their worst season ever and got approval to move the team to Oklahoma City. And it's a day away. We're off to the races. The Kentucky Derby starts tomorrow in Louisville. Eyes will be on the trainer, Todd Pletcher, who has two colts in the running to end his drought to win the race.
We're back to the Kentucky Derby. It seems like it was just yesterday.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the way it works. But you are also following that blast in Yemen, right? It just happened within the last 2 hours.
I'll get back to you on that. I'll get some more news. I've got some accurate latest figures for you, John.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Femi Okay.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for your responses. We've got more. We're going to talk about them in just a moment. 877-8-MY-TAKE is how you can get in touch with us. But it's Friday, so movies. The way we do the movies on The Takeaway is to offer you the exclusive mother of all movie trailers. And that means all the movies that are coming out this weekend we have in one comprehensive trailer produced by our own Jim Colgan.
Tom has his girlfriends.
You've been called the Da Vinci of our time. What do you say to that?
Tom has his guy friends.
They say the best weapon is one you never have to fire.
But he only has one best friend.
You don't tell me bears they are hiding, then I have no choice but to shoot you and your cat.
I'm working on something big.
You are going to be the stuntman in the film I'm making for ScreenTest.
Oh. Well, how about that?
Ready? Ready? 3, 2, 1, go!
all the trailers, all the movies being released this week. Joining us is David Wall Rice from Morehouse College. And the game is this. We don't review the movies. They're either art movies,
right,
or they're
escape
movies. Okay, starting with Iron Man. All right, billionaire
and
industrialist.
I just want to add that John came up with that, of course. Art
right,
or
palm
escape.
It up on me. All right, let's go. Robert Downey Jr. is Iron Man. Which one is this?
Escape, clearly.
Escape.
Yeah.
Well, just say a little about the movie. It's a billionaire industrious inventor gets kidnapped in a war zone and is forced to build a devastating weapon.
It's Michael Bay. I mean, that is Escape.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Okay.
How about the Son of Rambo, or
R-A-M.
A send-up of the Rambo movies?
Right, right.
Britain gets a hold of a Rambo movie and sets out to make his own sequel. A boy growing up in 1980s.
Yeah, that seems artsy, but it has a little escapism in it, too.
Artsy?
It's got to be escape.
Rambo?
It's spelled differently.
R-A-M-B-O-W.
Yes, exactly.
All right, this one's easy. Maid of Honor, M-A-D-E of Honor. Patrick Dempsey, Michelle Monaghan. A woman convinces her male friend to be her maid of honor in Scotland.
Escape.
I'm saying escape.
It's like chick flick, right?
It's Can't Buy Me Love.
Will you go
in
with
2008,
me?
Yep. You know?
Right.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah,
I think you're right.
I think so.
Other movies this weekend, there's Mamet, David Mamet. I guess that means art right there, right?
But Tim Allen's in
Red Belt. Red Belt.
The thing is, and that seems like it's a little bit of a Karate Kid grows up. And so I've seen some of the clips from it. It actually looked kind of escapish.
Really?
Yeah.
So that is, Red Belt is about a struggling jiu-jitsu teacher who rubs shoulders with Tim Allen, the movie star, and ends up with debts that are harder to pay. I love this one. Mr. Lonely, a Michael Jackson impersonator, finds like-minded people at a commune in the Scottish Highlands. Emotionally charged antics ensue.
David? I think that's art.
That's really forced art.
Forced art. Like postmodern
category.
Art.
No, new category, though. There's escape, there's art, and there's forced art.
Forced art.
Forced art.
Forced art.
And then there's Fugitive Pieces. A writer must face the buried memories of his childhood during World War II if he wants to keep his true love, based on the best-selling novel by Anne Michaels. That's
well, what do you
art.
Think? Yeah. Is it art? Is
it's
it escape?
Art.
If you art. Saw a movie, if you see a movie this weekend, log on to our website and leave your words of mouth. We'll be back. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, May 2nd. We have a quick update on the story out of Yemen, where officials are reporting that 8 people have been killed and many hurt in a blast at a mosque there. Security sources are saying that dozens of people were injured, and we'll continue to follow that story on our website. Also today, economic news. The Labor Department has just released numbers showing that the
unemployment rate down.
Down.
Unexpectedly. And we're talking about economic indicators all morning, and an economic indicator that actually is really, really interesting. It turns out that you can track pain, actual physical pain, by economic class. It's a new study out of Princeton University which says there is a pain gap in the U.S. economy. And economics professor Alan Krueger co-authored a study. Thanks for joining us, Professor. This is a really interesting result.
I have to say I was rather shocked myself when these results came up on the computer.
So explain what the gap is and how it manifests itself. Are we talking about the likelihood of doctors to prescribe prescription drugs, or are we talking about actual pain thresholds of people depending on income?
Well, we're not talking about either of those things. What we're talking about is how often people feel pain, even if they're taking pain medication. So what we did was we surveyed 4,000 people, and we asked them everything they did in the previous day and how they felt while they were doing it. And what we found was that people who make lower incomes tend to feel pain much more often in their daily lives and more severe pain.
Under $30,000 a year income, those people spend 20% more of their time in moderate to severe pain, or 20% of their time in moderate to severe pain, compared with 8% for those in households with income above $100,000 a year.
And that truly is an enormous difference.
It's an enormous gap, and we've known for a long time that lower-income people have lower life expectancy are less satisfied with their health. And this paints, I think, a broader picture about the way they live their daily lives.
Why?
Well, some of this, I believe, is due to differences in occupation and more physical demands of blue-collar work. We see, and we can do this with the kinds of data we collected, we could look at the amount of pain people feel while they're working compared to while they're not working. Blue-collar workers tend to have more pain while they're working. That carries over after work to some extent. For white-collar workers, they have about the same amount of pain during work and non-work episodes. Then, secondly, I think the arrow points in the other direction as well. People who feel a lot of pain in their lives find it difficult to work, and we find lower employment rates for people who spend much of their time in pain.
How do you deal with the, I guess, obvious idea that, yeah, it's a pain to be poor, and so, of course, I'm going to feel more pain? There's a quality to this that is obvious. How did you account for that and try to focus on actual medical feelings of pain?
Well, we also asked about other emotions. We also asked about feeling happy, about feeling interested in what people were doing.
So even happy poor people felt more pain.
And what we found was that people in lower-income households reported a higher frequency of pain and more severe pain. That's right.
Regardless of their emotional state.
That's correct.
Wow. See,
although I would say that the pain contributes to their emotional state,
sure,
too.
So
people who are not very satisfied with their lives or not very happy in their lives do tend to have more pain. But what really stood out in our data was the pain income gradient.
Now, it's interesting because you didn't distinguish between emotional pain and physical pain. Why not? And isn't there a difference between those two?
Well, it's an excellent question. And my co-author in this study is a psychologist, Arthur Stone. And what I learned from Arthur is that people feel pain in the head, all pain. A headache, is that emotional pain? Is it mental pain? Is it physical pain? Also, what the research has shown is that when people report their subjective feeling of pain, it does seem to correspond with the physiology, with either the stimulus that made them feel the pain or with the way that their brain has responded to the pain.
Well, that's a very interesting economic indicator. Alan Krueger, professor of economics at Princeton University, co-author of a study on the pain gap in the United States. Thanks for joining us.
Many thanks.
Wow.
Half a day, brothers and sisters of the Guam Federation of Teachers and my other fellow citizens of the westernmost part of our country. I wish I could be with you in person. I so fondly remember my visit to your beautiful island in 1995. With your support, I too will give you a president who pays as much attention to the needs of the territory as to those of the states.
Now that's
Senator
Hillary Clinton courting her brothers and sisters in Guam. Well, there's a reason. Because tomorrow they go to the polls in this tiny Pacific island, a U.S. territory. It has five precious superdelegates. And in this incredibly tight primary race, as we've all been talking, David Walrice here from Morehouse College, and of course you, John, my co-host. Very tight primary season. Every one of those delegates counts for Barack Obama and for Hillary Clinton. And Taling Taitano, you are one popular woman right now, aren't you?
Yes, certainly. I've been courted by both the Hillary camp and the Obama camp, and like you said, they're fighting over every delegate they can get.
And Taling, you are one of those super delegates. You are backing Hillary Clinton. When did you decide to go for Clinton, and why?
Well, back in December, I made the decision to support the Clinton campaign. I think that she's got the right mix of experience in this time of economic crisis. And
that's fine. Okay, you support Hillary. But what I want to know is how much have you been focused on by the campaigns?
Exactly.
I'm part of the Asia-Pacific caucus, and they've been calling me. And actually, I get emails from everybody every day. I get calls frequently. The Obama people are trying to convince me to come over to the other side. So every vote counts. So
have you felt torn at all? I mean, basically there are two superdelegates, yourself and your colleague who have made their decision of who they're going to.
Congresswoman Madeline Berdallo, yes.
The congresswoman has made her decision. But tomorrow, the people of Guam, their votes will dictate where the other three delegates go, to whom, I should say, the other three delegates go.
Actually, yes, that's true. Well, in a sense, the other three superdelegates get they don't run for a candidate, so pretty much they can decide who to support. But there is some of the teams have actually come out and committed. So there's like a team of chair and vice chair that have committed to Clinton.
But
we also have eight delegates that are running as pledged delegates.
I see. But this is unprecedented, this amount of attention to the Guam primary.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I mean, this has got to be an earthquake out there, right?
It's a country of 173,000 people, just to remind folks.
Well,
usually by the time we have our primary, it's already been decided. So with the contest so tight, everybody's focusing on each election.
Well, Taling Taitano, Democratic Party Committee Woman in Guam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
If you do end up deciding the campaign, we will fly you out here to New York. I think
you
so.
Heard it here. I
yeah,
think,
you heard it here.
And a few
yes.
other folks have heard
have
that. So we're going to hold
yeah.
him to that. You take care. Good luck tomorrow.
How does personal narrative play in Guam? Do you think, David Walrice?
Yeah, I would imagine it play big just like everywhere else. But it's amazing that it's so tight.
Absolutely amazing. That's David Walrice, assistant professor of psychology at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. We've got some economic indicators. You've been sending great stuff in. Adora, you first.
Well, Madison Avenue guys in good suits buying lunch from chicken and rice vendors for under $6. That's from Nancy on the web. She knows they're tough times.
Definite sign of an economic downturn. When most Americans talk about being careful, that's a sign of there being an economic downturn. Here's another one.
I'm Barbara from Brooklyn, and I think things are bad when people are turning to scooters, which are stolen easily and make the insurance companies happier, and these bikes that they think they're going to save money on and end up with an injury.
Oh, my. Well, here's what Eric Sanders from White Plains says. He says, you know what? I think this whole economy thing is getting overblown for political purposes, and it's just constant. I see it. I see it in the New York Times. You were thinking it was a great recession going on because guests went up. Prices went up and people can't sell their houses for six times what they're worth, but only three times what they're worth. And he's saying, you know what, maybe that's not so bad.
He also said, keep up the good work. And, you know, thanks for listening to us here on our first week. You can keep your responses coming to thetakeaway.org. We're going to keep reading your personal economic indicators on our website. And if you go to the movies this weekend, we want your reviews, but you only get six words. You can post them on our site.
And we'll read or play back the best of them next week right here and also put them on the website.
Yep. Send your reviews to mytakeitthetakeaway.org. If you got your cell phone handy, leave your review. Six words. That's all you get on our spin box line, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
That's 1-877-869-8253. And on our website, you can also hear our movie trailer mashup again if you
Mother
need
of
some
all
help
trailers.
Deciding where you want it, what you want to go see.
You can see me at Scooter Bodega in Red Hook. That video is going to be posted later today. Catch up with the Takeaways podcast. You'll find us on iTunes.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.